When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And welcome to Modern Day Debate. We are a neutral, nonpartisan platform welcoming everyone from all walks of life. If you're looking for even more fantastic debates, we are all over the internet, including your favorite podcasting platform. So if you enjoy debates, please don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe, including tonight's debate on Does the Left Ignore D-Trans Folks? With our debaters, Maddie and Malcolm, and Shapeshifter and Kat, here to help us find out. And if you enjoy what either of them have to say tonight, our guest links are in the description below. You can also tag me in chat at Amy Newman with your question or comment for our Q&A section. Those super chats will get yours sent to the top of the list. With that, I'm going to hand it over to the affirmative side for their 10-minute opening statement. The floor is all yours.
When you say affirmative side, can you just repeat the question?
Sure. Does the left ignore D-trans folks?
Okay.
I'll go first. Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Shape. I've been trans identified for 10 years. I had my sex reassignment surgery 7 years ago. 6 months ago, I came out as D-trans and started detransitioning by taking testosterone. Ever since I came out as D-trans, I've been mostly platformed by right-wingers or people who are leaning more right, which immediately made everyone assume that I sold out to the right, but I actually didn't. I would have loved to talk to somebody on the left, but nobody has approached me except for one media outlet that is British. And after interviewing me for an hour and a half, they decided not to air it. So that's where it's at. I've also been accused of being a grifter and sellout. However, I have not made any money on the interview. I've been also advocating against medical transition of kids under 18. So that's where I'm at. So I'll pass it to Kat.
Hi, I'm really thankful to be here today for this. Thank you for having me. My name is Kat and I'm a detransitioned woman. I identified as trans starting at age 13 years old. And I was not affirmed by my parents or my pediatrician or my peers back then. I'm 31 now. So this was in the mid 2000s when I was identifying as trans and coming out as trans. And so I ended up transitioning later as an adult. I mostly took testosterone as well as socially transitioning and coming out publicly. And unfortunately, I suffered some health side effects from the testosterone, which happened very quickly for me. I also was a semi-professional singer prior to transitioning, and I didn't realize that the testosterone would cause permanent and detrimental vocal changes. It made it so that it essentially became painful to talk, laugh, sing, and I was not able to perform for 2 years. I recently started performing again, but I have completely different voice now. And so when I was detransitioning, it became very clear to me the lack of support that there is for detransitioners in more ways than one. There, you know, there's a lack of support from medical professionals, for one thing. I tried to seek help for my voice, and almost no one knew how to work with a detransitioned female voice. I was told I could not really change my range at all. I was also gaslit and told there was nothing wrong with my voice when I was literally in pain every day. You know, I've heard from many medical professionals that they just really don't know what to do with detransitioners. So there's that side of it. There's the fact that I lost a lot of friends when I detransitioned. I was rejected by people within the trans community, some friends who were really close to me, and that was tough. And then finally, you have, of course, the media, which is obviously the subject of this debate. But, you know, prior to transitioning, I believed that detransitioning was rare. I believed it could not happen to me. You know, that there was a fraction of a percent of a fraction of 1% who detransition. And so just, you know, when you type detransition into Google, first you get left wing media outlets like NBC. Here's the title of one, for instance. This is from 2019, which is the year I started to transition. And that is, media's detransition narrative is fueling misconceptions, trans advocates say. They say the current narrative makes transition regret seem more common than it is and contributes to misconceptions about transgender people. And then a more recent article, this one's from KQED. It talks about children transitioning and how it's presented as California is a sanctuary state for trans youth coming from other states looking to receive gender affirming healthcare. But even within this study, there is a whole paragraph that says there's no solid data on how many kids remain satisfied with medical interventions or feel remorse about gender affirming transitions. And it talks about the lack of solid evidence about children who transition. And yet the way this article is presented is that it's very positive in terms of course, we should let kids transition. This is safe. And so what we've been seeing is just a very one-sided narrative from the left. And like Shapeshifter, I've had mainly right-wing outlets reach out to me, despite, you know, I've been a devout Democrat my entire life. I've always voted Democratic. I feel more politically homeless just because, you know, some of my views have changed surrounding this, but there's so much on the right I don't agree with. But I think it's important that anyone considering transition hears our stories, because detransition is a growing phenomenon. It is something that can happen. And anyone making a decision like this deserves to know both sides of the story. And it's frankly irresponsible for media outlets to ignore us. So that's kind of a summary on where I stand on the issue.
I also wanted to just add, I also had a lot of health complications from medical transition, and I do regret my transition, but I also want to put out a message that detransition in certain cases is not fully possible, especially if you've gone as far as I have, which is I've gotten all the surgeries that I could have gotten. And till today, I'm unable to have sex with my new vagina despite multiple revisions. And I have osteoporosis and scoliosis due to lack of hormones in my body for a few years. Thank you.
One thing, thank you, Shape. And I also just want to add that the left seems to be really glamorizing transition, because I think with both of us, there were so many risks, there were so many health risks, and the quality of the science is so much worse than what we were told it was and how it was represented to us. You know, I've brought a lot of citations with me about, you know, some of the science, and I'll go more into the flaws in the methodologies and things like that. But what happens is that transition gets glamorized, and, you know, I feel like the health risks especially are downplayed. And a lot of people are going into this and they don't even find out these health risks until, you know, months, years, sometimes down the road. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's too late. It's you can't always completely come back from your transition and reverse the effects. I have in a lot of ways, but, you know, like my voice, I've been living with vocal pain now for like 2 years, and I don't know, because I have this unique vocal anatomy, I don't know if that will ever change. And you know, you hear various health side effects from almost every detransitioner I've spoken with.
Yes, my back hurts every day because of osteoporosis. It's very traumatic to be back on testosterone and having my sex drive and not having functional genitals of some kind. And till today, I don't even know what exactly went wrong with my surgeries, despite being to so many different surgeons. So that's where I'm at. I also believe I am part of Trans Against Groomers. So it's people who transition as adults, but they don't agree that anybody under 18 should be transitioning, because you can make a consensual decision to something this serious and this lifelong.
Right. If we're not allowing children to get tattoos or drink alcohol or join the military, it's, you know, consent laws exist for a reason. It's because the brain isn't fully developed until the mid-20s usually. And for neurodivergent people, which a larger percentage of trans-identified people are neurodivergent than the general population. And so that brain maturation can happen even later in life for neurodivergent people. And also when you have people with severe mental illness as well, regardless of age, you know, if you're in a great deal of mental distress and desperation, it's not necessarily informed consent. And plus I would even go so far as to say, you know, the science, these interventions are still very experimental compared to other fields of healthcare. And so, you know, anyone going into this, even the doctors themselves don't have a good idea of the science. So yeah, I would dispute the whole concept of informed consent in this context.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with what Kat said. I had my surgery at 24 and I was 100% convinced that I was a woman and I will never regret this, but my sexual desires have changed and now I wish I had my penis back, but no matter what I do, I'm never getting my penis back. And I've talked to a detrans man who attempted to get phalloplasty and it failed and he had to reverse phalloplasty and take new phallus apart and put the skin graft where it came from. So it's just being part of the trans community, it's just a lot of people are suffering with permanent health damage due to transition and surgeries that they regret they've gotten.
About 1 minute.
Okay. And a lot of the trans women I know, because of testosterone, they don't know if they'll be able to have kids. And some of them are missing their breasts. They won't be able to breastfeed. Unfortunately, a lot of trans radical activists claim that the surgeries are reversible. And a lot of public at this point is convinced that you can just go and get sex change like it's nothing. But that's not the case. You know, you can't. And getting breast implants after a double mastectomy is just not the same once all the glands are removed, you know, and getting phalloplasty is also not the same as having a naturally born penis, I guess, natural penis.
And, you know, I think the left is characterizing us as just transphobic. Like we hate trans people. We're anti-trans. And I think that does detransitioners a huge disservice because, you know, at the end of the day, we're real people who have been hurt by this. And what we are trying to do is, you know, make care better for everyone. I think most detransitioners want the best for both the detrans and trans community. We want these people to have the best medical care. We don't want harm to those communities. And yet that is how we're being portrayed by the left.
Yes. And I wish I didn't get the bottom surgery because I was not aware that there were actually no studies showing that genital surgeries improve mental health at all. In fact, my depression, anxiety, and suicidality got worse after the bottom surgery.
And with that, I want to thank the affirmative side for their opening statements, and we're going to hand it over to the negative side for their up to 10-minute opening statements. The floor is all yours.
Cool. I'll start us off. So, first of all, I want to say that thank you to both Kat and Shape for sharing their experiences, because it takes a lot of bravery and courage to be open about when you go through something and it doesn't work out, especially when you feel harmed by it. So thank you for sharing your stories. And I do want to say that what you feel, maybe that you weren't provided enough information, and that if you had been provided enough information, maybe you would have made a different decision in terms of your treatment. I think that's totally valid. And I agree with Kat in that I think it makes sense to make sure that we're providing all that information, because regardless of whether you're going through a gender affirming procedure or even a normal procedure like a hip replacement or shoulder surgery, there's always going to be risks. And the best thing we can do to ensure that people are being safe and making the right decision for them and that they are setting themselves up to have the best possible outcome is by giving them that information. Now, to go back to the question at hand, this main, is the left ignoring detransitioners? One thing I think that doesn't surprise me is that it's right wing outlets that primarily seem to seek out these stories. However, I don't know if the rationale for doing so is because they feel that these, you know, oh, but we want to make sure people are being safe. What I seem to see more frequently is that they seek out stories about people who have detransitioned as a way to invalidate and diminish the existence of trans identities overall, and using that as evidence of why, you know, these trans identities are not valid or shouldn't be taken seriously. And that, I think, is where we find the biggest problem. Isn't that these are stories that are aren't worth telling, because they absolutely are. But when they're weaponized to then attack other people, people who are marginalized and suffering and being targeted right now, that is, I think, where the issue is. And I think I'll end with this and then I'll pass this over to Malcolm. But I think in all cases, care needs to be individualized. And one of the good things, at least I'm also based in California, about the care that's offered here is that it is a multi-pronged process where at the crux of the individual's care, the main motivator or desired outcome is reducing gender dysmorphia. If gender dysmorphia is there, that may include medical intervention, that may not. But at the end of the day, it's ensuring that the person is of sound mind, is not suffering unnecessarily because of their identity, and making sure that all the care that's being given to them is with their best interests at heart and mitigating any sort of risks. I'm looking forward to the rest of this discussion. Malcolm, you can go ahead.
All right. I think if we're asking the question, does the left ignore detrans folks? I think that in some scenarios you could say yes, but I would argue that the right does a similar thing. I know that a lot of people who are platformed as detransitioners, it's usually by right-wing people. But if we're looking at the kind of things that we want to see detransitioners have access to, these are going to be things like support, like reconstructive surgery, you know, community, all of these things. I know that Shapeshifter had mentioned, I think it was Shapeshifter and Kat also mentioned, kind of being politically homeless, where you kind of turned against this community and they rejected you. And I think that that's fucked up. And that's been a criticism that I've had of the trans community for a long time, is that there needs to be a little bit more openness and flexibility in how we support people, even if they aren't doing the things that we would want for ourselves. So I think in a way, the left does ignore detrans people, but I think that the people that the left are ignoring specifically are people that will say, because I transitioned and it wasn't right for me, I think that we should either have harder to access transition or we shouldn't let anybody transition at all. And I'm kind of indifferent on that. I think that if that's something that people choose not to platform, I think that's okay. There were a few things that I wanted to tag on to the end that Kat had brought up as far as detransitioning statistics. When we're talking about detransition itself as a whole, detransition within the community is really rare. If we look at this, I can drop this in the chat here in a second. And if we look at like a WPATH survey that was done in 2018, we can see that like it's like 0.1% of people who medically transition regret and then detransition. And additionally, if we're looking at children, who access medical care, either they go on puberty blockers or they identify as trans. With the Dutch cohort that was just done in 2022, we see that they persist into their identity like 98% of the time, I think is the number off of that one. And I can drop both of those in the chat. I'm really interested in where this conversation is going to go, because I think that there are valid concerns that detransitioners bring to the table, like the idea of being alienated from a community because you're not in line with what they expect you to do, which I think is obviously inappropriate. The lack of resources. I know that Kat had mentioned a little bit like the inaccessibility about working with your voice. Shapeshifter, I know that you've mentioned many times that you've had issues getting reconstructive surgery or accessing hormones in the opposite direction, so to speak. And I think that those are things that are kind of more of an issue than which voices like certain platforms are selectively deciding to platform. I know obviously that's the topic of the debate, but I think that that's like a little bit more important. So I'm excited to talk about that for sure. And I appreciate everybody and the invite, of course, as per usual.
Thank you so very much, all four of you, for your opening statement. And I'm going to remind everyone, please keep on tagging me at Amy Newman with your questions for the Q&A, as well as sending in any super chats that will send yours right to the front of the queue. However, with that, I'm now going to hand it over to all four of you for the up to 50 minutes of open discussion. The floor is all yours.
I just wanted to talk more about my medical history, because I was, believe it or not, this is going to sound like unbelievable, but nobody actually told me that I was supposed to be on some kind of hormone right after the bottom surgery. I know this sounds ridiculous, but nobody has, not people who gave me hormones first time in my life, not all the surgeons that did revisions on me over the years, because every time you go for a revision, you have to list the drugs you're on. And I told them, like, I'm not on estrogen because I was young and dumb. And I thought estrogen was just like for titties and ass. And I was like, I look feminine enough. I don't want to gain weight because I always struggle with body dysmorphia and weight gain. So I was literally living with a medical doctor who is literally still a doctor, still has his own like plastic surgery practice in Florida. He knew I wasn't taking estrogen. I was living with this person for 2 years. He knew I wasn't taking any kind of hormone. So yeah, nobody told me it's not just for TDs and ass. It's for your bone health. It's for your mental health. It wasn't up until I started having back pains and I didn't know what it was. I ended up having a bone scan and I realized like I had osteoporosis. I also went to a chiropractor who like sent me to x-rays, and I had scoliosis as well. That's when I realized I had bone density loss because of lack of hormones in my body. Moreover, I had not only like I was never able to have sex the way I wanted after sacrificing my healthy genitals, I literally like was not even aware that I to be able to like even have interest in sex and be able to achieve any kind of orgasm, I needed to have some testosterone in my body. And I did not know that up until I started detransitioning recently and taking testosterone. That's when I finally got some kind of interest, you know, in being able in having sex or like masturbating. And I just have to put this out there, you know, for people to know. And like, I literally could have at least been having like more orgasms had I known that I needed some testosterone, because testosterone is oftentimes demonized in M2F community as some things that like poisoned your body and put you through this like male puberty that destroyed you and made you look like a man. But it's needed for some, for health benefits and also to have sex drive. You know, what's the point of looking like a beautiful woman when you have no interest in any kind of intimacy other than cuddling, you know? And I am a homosexual transsexual, so like I'm attracted to men, and for me, like, I wanted vaginal depths, I wanted to have sex drive, and nobody told me any of this. I was so scared of testosterone, you know. And I also struggled for all these years with brain fog, lethargy. I had no energy. My anxiety has been through the roof because I was just a castrated man. I couldn't even be in the room alone without getting like panic attacks. Now I got my testosterone back. At least I can travel and be in a hotel room by myself if I need to. Before, I couldn't even do that without being apart from my cats, which just gave me anxiety. So I didn't know that, you know, nobody explained anything to me. I also want to mention that when I started taking estrogen, my mental health actually declined. And I believe estrogen induced bottom dysphoria in my case, because before taking estrogen, I was fine with my penis. But after I started taking estrogen, I became really dysphoric. I didn't want people like seeing my penis or touching it. So I believe like, and my therapist thought that I was just like in the wrong body. And I also made myself believe that I needed to have bottom surgery to feel complete, you know, but in fact, my mental health declined since, and I regret my medical transition. I even regret the top surgery because I have a lump in my breast, and eventually I'll have to remove my implants anyway, but I'll never get back my original body. Right now, once I do it, I'm going to look like F2M. I'm going to have like scars, and yeah, I completely regret it. And they're also super heavy, and they're already hurting my back. That's already weak.
Yeah, well, I want to also point out, and because thank you for sharing all that. And I'm really sorry that that was your experience, because especially when you seek the help of medical professionals, of course, you always think, no, but like they are medical professionals. They have my best interests at heart. I'm seeking their guidance because they're experts in this. And so to do that and then have it turn out so poorly is awful. And no one deserves to go through that. I do want to point out that something that's interesting that I notice a parallel is for women who take birth control. A lot of times, so some of the side effects that you mentioned, where feeling depressed or in some cases, like the reason I can't do hormonal birth control is because I no longer have control over my emotional responses, or at least that's how it felt. And I've had that before. But, you know, I knew that that was a risk going into it, you know, where it's like, okay, know to be on the lookout for these potential side effects. And then we can reassess whether or not this treatment is right for you. And then I ultimately went with the copper IUD, because the one with hormones, bad idea, like just was not, my body was not responding well to that. So I guess I have a question for you then, Shape. Do you think had you been given this information ahead of time, knowing the side effects or being briefed, do you think that would have changed your decision-making process?
Just like other, I mean, I knew that with estrogen, I was going to gain weight and get more emotional. Like that's obviously like obvious side effects. Just like, you know, a lot of D-trans women get accused, like, how the hell did you not know that your voice was going to get deeper? I think like other D-trans people and some trans people, I have other comorbidities, and one of them is OCD. So the minute I thought I was trans, I got so obsessed with transition. And plus that narrative that if you don't transition, you're going to be at a higher risk of suicide. And for somebody who struggled with mental health my whole life, to me, I was like, okay, whatever, I'll be like, actually, here's what happened. I was literally on estrogen just for a year in my life, because I was told that I needed to be a year to get maximum breast growth before top surgery. That's what I was told. And that's what I was on estrogen for a year. And then when I went off it, you know, and but I think it permanently did affect the way I saw it, and having estrogen in my body kind of confused me about my biological reality. I went from being a proud trans woman and being fine with my penis to being full-on convinced that I was like a real full-on woman and there is no difference between me and biological woman. That pushed me into like bottom surgery. I feel like, yes, I knew about those side effects, such as gaining weight and all that, but I guess nobody told me that you could feel actually more depressed, because I felt like as a trans woman, taking estrogen should have made me more happy, because from what I've read online, everybody was like, oh my God, I'm finally on the right hormone. And I feel so euphoric. But for me, it actually, looking back, it went down the hill. And I just was so obsessed with the final goal that I was like, I just need to complete my transition and live as a woman and then things will be better. That maybe I was kind of ignoring red flags, but also like I had mental health professionals that probably could have maybe clocked that maybe some of my increased mental health problems could be due to estrogen, you know, and mm-hmm. me being just a dude who was getting castrated, you know.
Or like, it sounds like you were, sorry for interrupting, but no, that is really
Maddie, helpful. Stop being transphobic and speaking over trans people. Jesus Christ.
You know, oh, that Maddie. But I think it sounds like, though, and I think it you alluded to it towards the end, how if you were, you know, in treatment for mental health things, and I've been in treatment since I was a teenager. So I understand. And it sounds like maybe if had there been someone who you could have seen that was more specialized in care, so had experience with people who are struggling with like gender identity or gender dysmorphia, and were more familiar with how that doesn't just have like physical, like it has effects on your mental health, but also once you start transitioning, there's another, you know, list of hurdles to know when to jump over or to avoid, or right. things to just be mindful of.
I just want to clarify, like, I always struggled with mental health, and I grew up in a third world country where like mental health is not something that's addressed unless you're like full on like crazy, quote unquote, to the point that you can't function in society. So the first mental health I ever received was to get surgeries letters for the surgery. That's like the sad part. I was prescribed hormones at Fenway Health, which is one of the largest LGBTQ, I guess, plus whatever hospitals, you know, and those people were supposed to be experienced with trans care. And I think that's where the problem lies. It was more of an activist hospital. And I think they were going to affirm it no matter what, instead of like looking at other issues that could have made me feel like I was supposed to be a woman. Like I was internalizing a lot of homophobia. I had OCD and borderline personality disorder, all those things I actually didn't know I had till after I had the surgery. So somehow they never like consulted me and pointed out that I could have other issues. I also actually have body dysmorphia. You keep on saying gender dysmorphia.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a new word you invented, I guess.
Just being transphobic. I'm sorry.
No, I was diagnosed with gender identity disorder because I'm old, I guess. So back then it was not gender dysphoria, it was gender identity disorder. But I realized actually this year when I went to a different therapist, I was not a gender therapist. Because I told her, like, no matter what surgeries I got, I still felt ugly and I felt uncomfortable in my body. And despite like people say, oh, you're gorgeous, you're beautiful, like I could only focus on scars on my body, on my like neo vagina and all that. And she told me, you have body dysmorphia. And then things clicked. Like I had abusive childhood, I had sexual trauma, and I did more research. And I definitely, like, no matter how much I modified my body, like that feeling of not feeling right never went away. So now I kind of still unpacking everything that happened to me, you know, and I realized I have all those other mental issues that created dysphoria, you know. And I think that's what I would like to promote moving forward. When I definitely, like, people say that I'm transphobic and all that, but like people are definitely struggling with dysphoria. But I think the first line when people come to therapists or voice concerns about dysphoria, we need to unpack like what exactly are they dysphoric about? Is it having certain type of hair? Is it something else? You know, is it something that could be fixed before like radical medical interventions such as like drugs and surgeries? And I feel like I wish I was shown more like mental health help more than like just sessions to get the letters for the surgery, because that's how it went down for me. You know, even though mental health is something I struggled with, I only went to therapists when it was time to get letters for the surgery. And that was the only time I went to therapist. And then I saw a therapist a few times after the surgery, and that's it. And then recently I went to therapy again once I was like super suicidal and decided to try to do transition, you know.
All right, I'm coming in for blood, okay? Because I love the sharing of personal experiences. I know that that's super helpful, but I'm here for blood, okay? I want tears. I want everybody to be in tears when we leave. So when you guys are talking specifically about detransitioners being like ignored by the left, what does that mean? Like, what would you like to see in lieu of what's happening right now?
I mean, we've seen Tucker Carlson platform a few detransitioners. We haven't seen Rachel Maddow talk to any detransitioners. You know, I would love to talk to Rachel Maddow, or not her, but like, I mean, her or somebody else on the left. Honestly, I'm new to politics. When I was convinced I was a woman, I was playing a stereotype. You know, I was like, not into politics, not into finance. Now I'm kind of like learning like what's left, what's right. Like, again, I'm politically homeless. But I would love to share my story with left audience, because we've been demonized as anti-trans, and some people sometimes say, oh, you're just a cis girl who is just a right winger. Like, I wasn't born a woman, and I'm not a full-on right winger. I'm like center right, I guess, at this point.
So if it's just the idea of people who are like platforming detrans voices. So like your example is Tucker Carlson, or like some right wing media will do this. What do you say in response to like that they're that the left in general, like CNN, MSNBC, all this other stuff, they don't really platform trans people in general. It's kind of like a very specific niche in conservative media. And do you feel like that does more damage? Because from my perspective, when you look at it, a lot of these people like don't actually give a shit about detrans people or detrans issues or offering them support or community. They want to take detrans people and make an example out of them and say, this is why we should be scared of transness, right?
I agree with you. I mean, there is definitely some people who are like full on transphobic, but there's definitely some people who are just concerned. And honestly, when I was receiving medical care, I thought I was in good hands because I thought I am in America, like people in white coats know what the hell they're doing. And honestly, I never wanted this. When people say like, oh, I'm a grifter and I'm doing this for attention, like I much rather have my health back. You know, I wish I never went down this route. And I will talk to anybody who will talk to me and raise awareness. And hopefully at least one person who needs to hear it will hear it and make the right decision. And yes, I am worried that sometimes I'm aligning with the wrong people, but that's what it came down to. Because when I have videos from 4 years ago talking about my complications and nobody cared, I feel betrayed and gaslit by trans community because they kept on telling me that I was just 1% like fluke regret rate, you know, like from complications and just regret. But so many people reached out to me in privacy and told me about their complications. There are people with colostomy bags. There are people who are numb from the waist down from bottom surgery. There are people who can't pee properly. They have to dilate their urethra. But guess what? None of the surgeons or therapists who gave me letters, they never checked on me. They have no idea. Maybe I killed myself. Am I happy? Nobody ever called me and not sent me a single email. So we're not, there's no follow-up. You know, I feel like trans people deserve better. I think a lot of people just really getting surgeries now at 18, 19, thinking that they're just going to go have one surgery and walk away with a functional vagina or a penis, but that's not how it works. I think people are being lied to, you know, and honestly, they should be aware that honestly, there's really no studies showing that bottom surgery helps anybody's mental health. In fact, there's studies showing the opposite, that suicidality went up compared to general population. And people should.
Well, the Swedish study actually shows the opposite. The Swedish study specifically states that post sex reassignment surgery, suicidality is decreased. It isn't decreased to like cis counterparts, but is decreased significantly.
The studies that I saw showed the opposite.
There's a lot I'd like to touch on here. So I think that Shape and I both had cases of, could you just tell me the title of this? I'm on my phone as a camera, so I can search on my computer, but what's the title of the study?
It's the big Swedish one. It's the long-term follow-up of transsexual persons undergoing sex reassignment surgery. It's the Swedish study. And I'm also going to drop this in the chat as well, because the author of this study has gone and done multiple AMAs on various different platforms because everybody is illiterate and can't read. And she's come out and said specifically that within this study, suicidality is decreased, but it doesn't decrease to like cis levels, right? Where it's like suicidality for trans people is here, pre-op trans people, suicidality for post-op trans people is here, and then suicidality for cis people is here. There's still a significant decrease in suicidal ideation, but it doesn't match like cis, like the cis controls.
But it's better. It shows improvement compared to trans counterparts who had not undergone surgery. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, while Kat is looking into it, just since we're on Sweden, Sweden was one of the first countries, and in general, Northern Europe, that's considered to be open-minded countries. So we're one of the forefront countries to start like doing surgeries and helping trans people with medical transition. And I remember my surgeon who did my first surgery, he's one of the oldest surgeons in the country who still does the surgeries, Dr. Sherman Liz. He always showed off how he trained in Sweden and all that. And Sweden and Finland are now backtracking on a lot of like medicalization of kids and all that. So like, and we're kind of still behind, I feel like. And they have some studies. I think me and Kat saw that when we were at a conference together, at a hearing together, they show that a lot of suicidality goes like up in after 10 years after transition.
Yeah, so I'm not interpreting, like I'm reading the discussion for this study right now. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's okay. Says mortality from suicide was strikingly high among sex reassigned persons also after adjustment for prior psychiatric morbidity. In line with this, sex reassigned persons were at increased risk for suicide attempts.
Yeah, so if you, I don't know if Can I send this to you on Twitter? I don't know if you have access to the chat.
Gender reassignment alleviates gender dysphoria. There is a need to identify and treat co-occurring psychiatric morbidity in transsexual persons, not only before but after sex reassignment. So,
do you want me to? I can send these to you on Twitter if you want to, because the author of this study has come out and said specifically that the findings interpret that post-op trans people have a lower suicidality than pre-op people. It just doesn't meet the threshold of like the cis control. I can send them to you on the discussion pieces that she's done after the fact on Twitter. I put them in the chat on here, but if you're on your phone, I don't know if
And I just want to say, if you put them on Twitter, I will also make sure that the links go into the our chat here as well.
Yeah, put them in the group chat really quick.
Even though surgery and hormonal therapy alleviates gender dysphoria, it is apparently not sufficient to remedy the high rates of morbidity and mortality found among transsexual persons.
Yeah, so, like I just said, the suicidality is still elevated, but it's not, it's lower than people who are pre-op.
It's still like there. That means that, like, just by being identifying as trans, whether or not you've gone through any sort of medical transition, suicidality is higher than their cis counterparts. I think a lot of the studies show that that is mostly correlated to pressures or stigmas.
Even Lisa Littman's detransition studies echoes the same thing, where a lot of it is societal pressures. But if we're talking specifically about the Swedish study, it's like the suicidality is lower than non-transitioning trans people, but it's still higher than cis controls. And that's to be expected with like a marginalized group. And I'm sure that if you looked into it too, detransition people have like extremely high rate for suicidality as well. It's not just because they're detransitioning. Just because a lot of the things that come along with it, right, like complications or dissatisfaction or dysmorphia or whatever, it's not just like they got surgery, they're not going to kill themselves. They did get surgery, they are going to kill themselves. It's a little bit different, right?
Did you ever cross your mind that maybe some people?
When it comes to the detransitioners, the major reason people detransition is because of social influences, social pressure, that sort of thing. So that survey that data comes from was a survey of a population that still identifies as trans. And there's been two surveys. Both were from 2021. One was by Ellie Vandenbusch and the other one was Lisa Littman. And these were surveys of specifically detransitioners. And external pressures in both studies was one of the rarest reasons for detransitioning.
Wrong. And I'm looking
at the
Lisa Littman
one
right
all.
Now. The most frequent endorsed reason for wanting to transition or wanting to be perceived as target gender.
Can you pull up the studies like you did with yours?
Yes.
And this is from 2021, and I know, Shape, you had mentioned Fenway. This was a study conducted by Fenway Health, and what it found was that the most common reason cited for detransition was pressure from a parent at 35.5%. At 32%, it was pressure from their community or societal stigma. For those who had detransitioned. So Fenway people who Health no longer identify as trans. They were asked why they had chosen to detransition. And these were the reasons that were cited. And of all of that, only 2.4% of those people who reported post-detransition attributed this to doubt about their gender identity, while only 10.4% attributed their post-detransition to fluctuations in gender identity or desire. And again, this is just what the data is showing, and those results are echoed through a number of studies where it seems as though the main reason for a lot of these people to detransition is directly correlated with societal influence.
This is so currently identified transgender people. This is currently identified transgender people who have detransitioned at some point. This is not the same population being surveyed in the Littman study and also in the Vandenbusch studies. So
yeah, and the Littman study still cites 38% as external pressures.
We know from these other studies that the majority of detransitioners in both studies, the vast majority no longer identify as trans, so that would have left them out.
I'm a little confused. Sorry, I just want to make sure I get some clarification. Yeah. So when you say they are not trans or I guess my assumption was that in the study where they show people, they followed a number of people over the course of a certain set of years. And then of that initial population, there was a subset that chose to detransition or, you know, revert back to identifying as the gender they were assigned at birth. Would that not be classified as, well, they are no longer trans because they had chosen to detransition? I guess I'm just confused on where that difference in like definition is.
So you're pulling from the Fenway Health, right?
Mm-hmm.
From 2021. So that pulls mm-hmm. from the 2015 US Transgender Survey. So this is surveying a population of people who said yes to the question, do you identify as transgender or gender diverse? I think it is. And so most detransitioners, which has been, you know, obviously more research into this is needed. I'm not saying this is 100% definitive, but so far the two studies on a population who say they are detransitioners, the majority of them do not, they did not transition because of external pressures. They detransitioned mostly because they became more, 60% because they became more comfortable identifying with their birth sex, and about half of them because of medical complications. So that was in one study. And then the other one, 70%, this is from Vandenbosch 2021, they realized their dysphoria was related to other issues, 70%, and 60% were due to health concerns. Only 13% detransitioned due to lack of social support, and only 10% said it was because of discrimination.
That's only people that say, I do not identify as this.
It's of people who say they have detransitioned specifically.
But and so those people, whether, and that's regardless if they identify as trans or not. It's just people that have detransitioned.
Of people who say they have detransitioned, only a small minority still identify as transgender or non-binary. The majority, go back to living as their birth gender. So the survey from 2015, it was surveying transgender adults. So of the people who are still trans identified, it makes sense that, you know, the reason they may have detransitioned at some point was an external factor because they still identify as trans, but that's not what we're seeing with detransitioners. So it's not an accurate characterization of people who detransition. And furthermore, we don't actually know that transitioning is rare, that detransitioning is rare, because again, most of the studies designed on detransitioning are designed to leave most detransitioners out. Because also from the Littman study, we know that the majority of detransitioners, well, less than a quarter actually had reported to their medical provider. So most do not go back to the same clinic or medical provider.
Right. And in a bunch of those studies, in a number of those studies, one of the issues that a lot of people take with it were that when people did not return to the medical facility or to the doctor, the assumption was then made, oh, they must not be transitioning anymore. They must have detransitioned. And so they mark it as that, ignoring that there are plenty of reasons why someone may not return to a certain medical facility that don't involve, you know, oh, well, they were just going to mark it as they detransitioned. I know there was a big study in 2013 that's cited pretty frequently for people who maybe want to put more strict controls on gender affirming care. And they cite that study while not acknowledging or like conveniently ignoring that the way that data was presented wasn't necessarily reflective of the behavior of those subjects. So I just wanted to point that out, that like that is another issue in terms of deriving findings.
Well,
and the WPATH survey from 2018 had the same thing, where they would mark it if there was no responses. Yes. And even with that, the cohort, it was like 0.01% of people detransitioned.
Like, I've worked in marketing for a long time. I've conducted studies like this, and that's why methodology and documentation is so critical in these, because you can make data kind of say whatever you want if you assign certain values to different behaviors or phenomena that you see happen. Whether it's people, it's a study where people are simply answering questions, or whether it's like a behavioral study.
I don't know about the study from 2013 that you're referring. I haven't personally seen a study where the methodology was used that if a person didn't follow up with the clinic, they were considered detransitioned. I've never seen anything like that. I'd be happy to take a look. The three largest studies on detransition that exist, besides the one from 2015, were done by combing through medical records, and only people who had reported detransition were considered to have detransitioned. And yes, those detransition rates in these three studies were all less than 1%. However, since we know that, most detransitioners have said they do not go back to their provider, they do not tell the clinic, again, that is leaving out a potentially large percentage of people. And so I agree with you that data can be, interpreted and, twisted to fit a certain narrative, but, the truth is that, the research that exists is simply it's not strong enough to claim that less than 1% detransition.
I included the link to the study in the chat here, but all right. Sorry, Shay, you can go for it.
Name of it. I'm sorry, because I'm just on my computer, so I'm not able to go from the chat, but
Can
you just tell me the name
put
of it?
Put it on the Twitter chat. Can you get on the Twitter chat on your phone?
Yeah, I'll share it on the Twitter chat.
I just wanted to say Dr. Alex Krigulin, who is mentioned in this Fenway link, he was my therapist, who was one of the mental health professionals who gave me one of the two letters for the surgeries that kind of forever changed my timeline and not for the better. And also, I've been trying to reach him and tell him that I regret my transition and I haven't been able to even reach him because I'm actually in a different study at Fenway. And I've been telling them that I'm detransitioning. I've been telling them I have a YouTube channel, and they've been completely ignoring me, actually. Honestly, I've been trying to reach Dr. Alex Krigulin and tell him, like, hey, like, I'm detransitioning. Like, I regret, like, bottom surgery, and I haven't been able to even reach him. I wonder, all they had to do is just send me an email and see how I'm doing, and I would have said not so well. It's weird that they are, like, doing the studies, but they never reached out to me, and it's hard for me to reach to him, so just putting it out there. And Fenway Health is an activist hospital there, which I guess can be biased as well, they want certain type of outcome from their data.
Maddie, would you mind just telling me the name of that study? Because I am not a member of the group chat. I asked to be added, but I...
Oh, I shoot. Added. Yeah.
So if I could just search it really quick, that would be great.
Yeah. So the name of the study is called Factors... it's kind of a long title.
One from Jack Turbin, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think that... It's just called Factors Associated with Desistance and Persistence of Childhood Gender Dysphoria, a Quantitative Follow-Up Study. And Thomas D. Steensma.
Okay. So yeah, in this one, we're talking about adolescence, and it's a sample of 127 people. Okay. Thank you.
Yep. No problem. And then so there was another one I was looking at, and I believe this one is Turbin. It's the Turbin study that you would reference. And I know that a lot of that is pulling from the I think what you said, the National Trans Survey. Yeah, but there were some interesting findings from that, and that was research where the sample size was just over 17,000 people, and that's people who had ever socially transitioned, so separate from medical transitioning, and it found that 86.9% persisted in their gender identity. So I think you're right in saying that, it's saying that only 1% don't is misleading, because you're right. Like there, it looks, the truth is that it, in this particular case and with other cases that I've seen, it's probably closer to about, 14 to 15%. But of those just over 2,000 people who reported that they had reverted back to living as the gender that they were assigned at birth, only about 15% of that group said they did so because of internal factors, such as questioning their experienced gender. But more often, the rationale given was that it because of fear, mental health issues, or suicide. I'm sorry, that's part of it. So fear, mental health issues, and suicide attempts, and not identifying with the gender and like dissatisfaction. The rest of the report said that it was mainly social, economic, and familial stigma and discrimination that was a primary driving factor.
But again, characterizing those people as detransitioners, it's the population that was being surveyed makes those results not applicable to the majority of people who identify as detransitioners.
Why wouldn't you? So even though they've now reverted back to living as the gender with which they were assigned, and these are people that didn't necessarily begin medical transition, they had just had begun social transition. What about them doesn't make them a detransitioner when they had initiated that transition and then gone back? Why wouldn't that?
15% of the 15% who, you know, did identify as trans and now have, you know, returned to living as their birth sex. I mean, it's a miracle that any of them even appeared at all, because in a sample that, you know, the survey is sent out and it says, you know, do you identify as transgender? Or, you know, gender divert. And so if a survey like that goes out, you know, the majority of detransitioners are going to steer clear of that. You know, they no longer identify that way. And a lot of us have been harmed by gender care. And, you know, a lot of us feel that socially transitioning and just embracing the ideology at all was harmful to us psychologically. And so, you know, and, you know, also based on the studies of specifically detransitioners. So anyway, that is a different population than a population of detransitioners. So, you know, while it, you know, may be useful to study a population that is trans identified for other reasons, it's not an accurate characterization of detransitioners. It's two completely different populations.
Do you have any data? Sorry, go for it, Malcolm.
I was going to say, you can make the same argument for the Lippmann study, because she does snowball sampling on like RD trans closed Facebook groups on Tumblr, Twitter, Reddit, all this other stuff. You could say the same thing, that we're going to see like this massive selection bias, just like you saw with the ROGD study, where it was snowball sampling from like Fourth Wave Now. So like, I understand where you're coming from, where like the nitty gritty of this is somewhat important. Like, where are these samples coming from? Like, are they representative of the target population that we're looking to sample? But the reality is that the studies that are going to be the most reliable are ones that are done by servers, what's the word I'm looking for? Fuck. Providers offering that service. Like, those surveys are going to be the ones that are the most reliable, because like Maddie said, in a lot of these, what they're doing is if they're not following up, they're checking off the box that says, oh, well, this person probably changed their mind. And if we look at physician surveys, those are going to be the most accurate, because we're not snowball sampling out of like specifically ideologically charged groups. I would be just as skeptical if we did like, you know, a study that was like, how happy are you with like your bottom surgery results, but we only snowball sampled like pro bottom surgery groups, are like bottom surgery is amazing, bottom surgery is so much fun and it's free and it changed my life for the better. I would have the same kind of critiques. And so if we look at things like the Lippmann study, we're also having those issues, which is why I always defer back to the WPATH survey that was done, where they survey providers, because regardless of what we're talking about, if we're snowball sampling on the internet, we're going to have a big issue with our biases with our populations.
Shape, I just want to say something really quick. So the both detransitioners that are here today would not qualify for inclusion in the 2015 transgender survey.
I'm not talking about that one. I'm talking about the WPATH survey that was done in 2018.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't that draw? I think we just established that draws from the same population,
no,
though.
It was a physician survey. So they sent out surveys to providers that perform gender affirming care, including surgeries and hormones. And they surveyed, have you ever encountered a patient that has regret? What was the reason for that reported regret? Do they no longer identify as trans? Was it because of medical complications or anything like that? And it's a reported survey from providers that provide that care. It's not from the people who are receiving the care. It's from the providers that offer that care.
Well, I would, you know, given some of the recommendations that WPATH puts forward as part of their guidelines, such as UNICS and performing surgeries on children, I would be skeptical of
You're just going to hand wave them asking providers that offer this service. You're just going to hand wave that because they wrote a standard of care that you don't like.
I'm reading through it right now. I can't. It's hard for me to look at the details of the methodology while being present for this debate. I will look into it. However, I don't believe that is an unbiased source as you're suggesting. But I'd like to hear Shape. What did you have to say?
It's back to WPASS. The president of it is Marcy Bowers, who has a private clinic and has been making millions of dollars for years from trans surgeries. And I just want everyone to know that Marcy Bowers recently officially stated that all the kids that have been blocked out on Tanner stage 2 M2Fs will never have an orgasm because they never had testosterone in their body. So,
I think that's bullshit. I want to see
a source. Yeah, that sounds like bullshit to me.
I want to see a source from that other than Marcy Bowers.
Okay, sure. From Marcy Bowers? Absolutely.
Yeah, because I could say that I saw a purple alien yesterday and it's like, well...
No,
it's Dr. Malcolm.
This is not a purple alien, sweetheart.
I've seen it too.
Testosterone.
Shape, are you able to share your screen?
Also, I don't have a lot of testosterone, and I orgasm just fine.
They were puberty suppressed starting at tender age too, so their reproductive organs are literally never develop. So they will experience sexual dysfunction because.
You can argue infertility, but there's
you experience that, and
there's no data on this at all.
If you have data that shows that this is largely like a big problem, then otherwise it's anecdotal. And while like it sucks if someone experiences that themselves, and like I have a lot of sympathy for that. Is it whenever you have any sort of medical procedure and you experience negative side effects, like that sucks. It sucks. But at the same time, to then attribute it to saying this is going to happen to everyone else, then it's like, no, it's anecdotal, it's personal. It doesn't make it suck less, but like, let's call it what it is.
But you're a natal female, comparing your experience to a man who has a new vagina, it's a completely different story, saying that you're able to orgasm because females naturally have some testosterone. My testicles have been removed. I don't think it's a fair comparison.
I don't have testicles, so my testosterone doesn't come from that either.
Okay, but your biology is different. You're a woman.
But would you say that was because you just weren't, like, it sounds to me like you were working with doctors who didn't communicate certain things to you. They also didn't have you on specific, like the proper set of hormones and other things. Like, and that sucks. Like, my heart breaks for you because it sucks that you experience that. Like, it makes me really mad because we do entrust our medical team, like whether it's for gender affirming surgery, whether it's like for cardiac care, we trust them to have our best interests at heart and to give us care to make sure that we're being healthy and happy. But at the same time, like, I don't know, it's like missing the forest for the trees, where in this particular instance, it sounds like there was just a lot of missed opportunities to provide information and education so that you could make a truly informed decision. I would hesitate to identify that as a larger trend.
Well, I was treated at Fenway Hospital for, that's the hospitals that gave me letters for the surgery and gave me hormones, Fenway Health, literally. And surgeons that worked on me are still working on people, till today. Dr. Sherman Lee still has his practice open. All the surgeons have never stopped performing surgeries. It's way too lucrative. I just send you a YouTube video. You can just watch first 3 seconds where Marcy Bowers admits that anybody who had blockers, M2F, are not going to have an orgasm. So how kids can opt out of ability to orgasm when they never had one? I don't think it's fair.
Are you saying that
the argument is that every kid that takes hormone blockers before
F2Ms. I'm talking about M2Fs.
That's the only person that's ever said that is Marcy Bowers, and she just says that. She doesn't really have anything to stand on. It's just like what she
said. I'm going to interrupt all four of you. Shapeshifter, if you get that link to me into Twitter, I will get it into the chat here. But I also just want to say that we have about 10 more minutes of open discussion for the panel, and then we're going to move into the Q&A. So please keep on sending in those chats and super chats. And if you enjoy the debate, please don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. But right back over to you all.
So I can definitely... So nearly every detransitioner I've ever talked to expresses similar concerns about the quality of care that they received. And going beyond detransitioners, something that trans activists often advocated for is called the informed consent model. And in your opening statement, Maddie, you said that in California, I believe you said you're based in California, and that here, really comprehensive care is provided.
I guess it depends. Yeah, I did say that. And I guess it really does depend on like what, I don't know, different hospital systems or medical, whatever, are like different, like Sutter Health is going to be, or Kaiser is going to be different than like Stanford Healthcare. But overall,
So I know a detransitioner from Kaiser who's currently suing. She transitioned prior to the age of 18, and she's currently suing her provider at Kaiser. Because one thing I hear over and over again through people who went through Kaiser, went through Planned Parenthood, especially as a big one. I was affirmed after 30 minutes at Planned Parenthood. I was prescribed testosterone on my first appointment, which was a telehealth appointment. And so they never met me in person. I picked up my prescription.
Yeah, how old were you?
I was in my late 20s. But this is something I hear from like Chloe Cole. She was affirmed immediately at age, I think, 13. And I hear this from parents all the time of, you know, either children who are currently trans identified or desisted children that providers are affirming immediately. And, you know, this is That's something so that the true. Informed consent model that trans activists mm-hmm. encourage, you know, that is something they're calling for. Like they're calling for there to be fewer barriers for people to access gender care, not more. And yet, you know, people are being harmed by this. I think if, you know, when you have people coming in with comorbidities, and a lot of times someone who's suffering from severe distress about their body, you know, a lot of times they tend to have comorbid mental illnesses. And, you know, these people are being affirmed immediately. And this is something I hear over and over again. So I don't think it's just, an unusual rare occurrence like Shapeshifter is describing, or like I'm describing, where the care is not comprehensive. It's very much putting people on a conveyor belt towards transitioning and not considering, you know, A, the risks, and B, you know, if this person can truly provide informed consent.
So while I can't answer for specific doctors handling it differently, I can speak to the guidelines and proposed process that the folks at the Endocrine Society recommend. And this is specifically for minors who are experiencing just questioning of their gender identity. And it's also...
I don't even think that we need to get into it with the kids, though, right? Because nobody here transitioned when they were a kid.
That's also true. Yeah, yeah, because it's about detransitioning. But I will say that, like, and I only speak to the process because it's something, and this is also the American Academy of Pediatrics, but overall, they have a pretty set recommendation for how to address at each stage a patient who is considering transitioning, and making sure that the care is individualized so that they are properly evaluated, and that, you know, the goal isn't necessarily medical transition. It's more like giving them the treatment they need to align with how they see themselves, to put them in a position for a better mental health outcome or just life outcome in general. And for some people that involves medical transition, but for a lot of people that social transition is enough for getting some sort of like psychological help, counseling. But they have a pretty strict, I know I don't want to say strict, but like very set recommended guidelines. So it sounds like if the question is, you know, how do we prevent people from making snap decisions, that implementing stricter like guidelines for that care, or like stricter like protocols, is what would you think that would be like a more desirable outcome?
Of course, so, we need gatekeeping as soon as possible, because a lot of people that things are trans are not trans, and they're not going to benefit from the surgeries. You know, they're going to have their body permanently altered, you know, and
especially children, you know, because I mean, I don't think anyone under 18 can consent to any of this, you know.
As children get, do you have a problem with cis children getting hormone treatments
or SSRIs or stimulants?
I mean, I was on stimulants, I fucked up my health. So
yeah, SSRIs will fuck you up real hard.
Oh, team SSRIs right here. What's up?
Dude, that benzo induced mania is fucking wicked.
Benzos are a whole different animal. Benzos are scary.
It's fucking scary that they give like minors Wellbutrin and shit.
But that's what I guess puberty blockers. I ask,
and they're still, you know, they still have risks. But with puberty blockers for gender dysphoria, there's never been any clinical trials. And furthermore, this is altering the body to treat mental illness. And this isn't the type of care that we use to treat.
But
we don't use body modification as a treatment for anorexia. Well,
Sorry.
Stop silencing trans people, Maddie. Stay in your lane. Oh my God. So two things. The first thing is that we know what Lupron does to the body. It doesn't magically have a different effect because we're using it in trans kids. Hormone blockers have been used for decades in cis kids to treat precocious puberty. It's been close to 40 years now. Can I finish, please? Thank you. We have a decent body of work as to like what these do to the body, and we're pretty aware of it. So there are side effects and there are risks to every medication. Absolutely. That's unquestionable. But to pretend that it magically does something different in trans kids versus cis kids is not true. Second of all, the reason that we don't treat anorexia by giving people liposuction and like telling them to, you know, binge and purge every single day and only eat like 2 almonds for lunch is because it's a dysmorphic disorder. When you can give an anorexic person all of the interventions in the world, they can have 0% body fat. They could literally be a walking skeleton. And when they see themselves, they still have this warped perception of themselves. There is no tangible end to what this is, right? They have a distorted view of reality. Dysphoria isn't a distorted view of reality. It's accepting reality and then wanting to change it or choosing to change it, right? Like I have huge juicy double D's and I don't want huge juicy double D's anymore, so I'm going to get them removed. That's different than being like, oh my God, I'm 100 pounds, but I'm still like this fat fucking cow and it's disgusting. I shouldn't eat anything. Those are two totally different things that are not comparable at all.
Well, believing that you are a man, if you're a woman, or if you're, you know, if you're a child, believing you're a boy when you're a girl, I would say that's a delusion. You know, I think it's like,
no, it's about the visual perception. It's about the visual perception, because you can make an anorexic person be skin and bones and they'll still look in the mirror and see a fat cow. You can have somebody who's dysphoric who looks in the mirror and acknowledges like, yes, I got a gorilla grip juicy pussy and like huge fucking gazongas, but I don't want that. It's the acknowledging of reality and wanting to change it. It's dysmorphic when you look at it and it's not a correct representation of what you visually see, right?
Also, like what we talk about, I mean, the hormone treatments are one thing, because those are things that have been used in cis minors for a long time for a variety of mental conditions. But there's also, so recently I read this article about a 14-year-old boy who, because of a hormone, it's like this innate condition he had, he grew boobs. Cisgender boy who identified as a male who grew boobs, and he ended up getting surgery to remove them because they made him self-conscious and were a product of this like unfortunate condition that he was then getting treatment for. But like, because he was going to school, he was like feeling really insecure that he was a cisgendered man who had tits, and he got them removed. But I don't see people up in arms about him as a cis child getting gender affirming care in the same way I see people get up in arms about trans kids getting gender affirming care. It just feels like it's a moving goalpost.
In that case, it's healthy children getting cosmetic medical interventions, you know, precocious puberty. Like, we can have a discussion about that can cause issues later.
So do you not think he should have been able to get that surgery?
No, well, I don't think you should have, because men can have boobs.
Sorry, go ahead, Shay. I'm sorry to interrupt.
First of all, when I went through puberty, I also had small TDs, and I don't know till today. I wanted to get tested for intersex conditions, but it's apparently insurance doesn't cover it. Imagine it covers all other things, but I can't get tested for DSD conditions. And men can have breasts. I date chubby guys. They have breasts. I mean, no, that child should have not had
these. Gynomastia is different. It's like actual like B cups, like literal tits.
Like, because bazongas, I don't know.
I think we should normalize men having small breasts boobs. And have times where I'm getting double mastectomies.
I am actually going to now separate, but give each of you the chance to just surmise your position, as well as tell everyone out there what you got going on in the world or the interwebs. This is right before we get into the Q&A, so please keep on sending in those questions. It really has been a great debate, so I want to thank all four of our interlocutors. But either way, whoever would like to go first, the floor is yours.
Can I go first so I can go to the bathroom? Can I go first so I go to the bathroom? Really quick? Okay, sorry. I'll be really quick. I just really have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, I've heard when women take teas, they have to pee often.
True. Who was that today that said that testosterone made them pee their pants? That's a really weird side effect. I've never heard of that one before, but I guess it's coming for me. It's coming for me. I haven't ever pissed my pants, but who knows? The future is bright and long. Mm-hmm. I'm Malcolm. God damn it, Malcolm on everything. I'm a trans guy. I talk about trans stuff as a trans guy. I also have a decent amount of content talking to detransitioners and talking about detransition topics. So I would like to offer this opportunity to Kat and Shape both if they ever wanted to talk. I'm not nearly as spicy on like one-on-one conversations. This is supposed to be a debate. So, you know, we were here for blood. I wanted to bring a little blood. So that is open. If that's something that you guys would like to do in the future, no issues. My kind of final thing is, I think that it's important to realize that there are side effects and risks to every kind of medical procedure that we kind of undergo, right? And some things don't work for some people. There are certain SSRIs that don't work for some people, like Wellbutrin was horrible for me. But I know for a lot of people, Wellbutrin was great. The same way that transition has been really good for me, and I'm really happy with my transition, and maybe for Kat and Shape, they don't feel the same way. But that doesn't mean that we just like pull the plug on that treatment just because there are people that are dissatisfied, right? I think that's kind of like an insane way to approach it. And if we're talking about the left ignoring detransitioners, I agree 100% with Kat and with Shape that there is a really big problem with the way that we abandon detrans people because they're not pursuing transition the way that we want to. And I think that that's something that we need to work on for sure as leftists or people on the left or trans people or whatever group you're in, because like detrans people are basically in the same boat, right? Like just trying to be comfortable with themselves, be happy with their body. They need access to resources. They need community. They deserve to be able to talk about their stories, right? Maybe I disagree with some of it and that's fine, but that doesn't mean that they don't have a right to talk about their experiences and their stories. And I think that we can do better in facilitating healthy relationships with detrans people, that just because, you know, a Kat or Shape aren't trans anymore, or they don't identify as trans anymore, that doesn't mean it's just like, fuck you, get out of the community. You have to burn every bridge that you've ever had. I think that that's ridiculous. And I think that we could be better about that and be kinder to each other about that. So
thank you.
That's all. Mm-hmm. That's all I got. All right. I'll be back, guys.
Okay.
Thank you so very much. And whoever is next in line.
Okay. I guess I'll go. I still don't believe, I feel like if adults want to modify their bodies and want to achieve certain look, they have a right to, but I don't think it's fair for kids to risk their fertility and their health for a certain look. And I still believe kids under 18 should not be transitioning. I believe nobody should be getting genital surgeries under 25 because it takes people time to mature and realize who they are. Sexuality can change. Sometimes you feel like you don't need certain body part, but then you may want it later on. And I feel like data on both sides are riddled with flaws and riddled with biases, but you cannot hide a body count. And I feel like detransitioners are the body count. I do feel like current affirmation only model has a lot of flaws. There should be more pushbacks. There should be more mental health exploration before people are allowed to have permanent body modification, especially genital surgery. And in time, everything will be revealed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so very much, Malcolm and Shapeshifter. And who's ever next?
I guess I'll go next. I'm Kat. I thought this discussion did get a little bit heated at one point, and you know, I apologize for you know, if I was a little over the top at that part. I'm really passionate about the science because I do have a background in molecular biology. And so looking at the science and actually reading through these studies and the methodologies has been, you know, a big part of why I hold some of the positions that I do. And the truth is that in medicine, it's never safe until proven unsafe. It's always unsafe until proven safe. Or in most cases, I mean, you know, there's been lobotomies, there's been some other things, thalidomide, things like that. But, you know, the vast majority of the time to recommend invasive treatments, you have to have extremely strong evidence for those treatments. And that is just simply not the case in trans healthcare. I do think just the studies in general, you know, even the studies on detransitioners, we need better quality data. And I think we have surged ahead with performing experimental procedures on people and prescribing hormones that are actually known to be detrimental. So this, it's not the same level as like a side effect of a drug. It's the side effect is the effect. So we already know from studies on like female bodybuilders, for instance, or men with naturally high estrogen populations like that, we already know that, you know, high amounts of these substances can cause cancer, it can cause diabetes, it can cause stroke, heart attack, things like that. So we already know these substances are dangerous. And so, you know, I do believe in, you know, in freedom, and I understand the urge to transition and, you know, wanting to change your body to make you feel more comfortable. And I have the utmost empathy for that, actually. But I do think that these surgeons and doctors are violating the Hippocratic Oath by prescribing these treatments for in essentially every case, but especially under 18s, because again, children, you know, if they cannot consent to drinking alcohol, having a tattoo, they cannot make a decision about their fertility or their brain health or their bone health. I mean, there's already evidence that these the puberty blockers in particular are causing osteoporosis. So that's where I stand on the whole thing. Once again, I have immense compassion for anyone who identifies as trans, or you know, is feeling just gender dysphoria, discomfort in their own body. I empathize greatly with that, and you know, I really wish them the best, and I would like to see other options for treating gender dysphoria being studied.
Okay. Yeah. So hi, I'm Maddie Cakes. And thank you again. I know Kat said it did get a little spicy. I feel like this has been one of the most like respectful debates I've been a part of. So like, while it did get spicy, like I actually thought that the discussions that we were having, while both sides feel really strongly, clearly, I thought it was really productive and I enjoyed it. And so I want to thank both of you as well for being so open to not only like engaging with us, but also sharing your own side of the story. Because one thing I think we can all agree on, and Malcolm touched on this in his closing, that I do think that the community, whether someone is trans, whether they are an ally, we need to be more accepting of people who, for whatever reason, have gone through a detransition. And accept that's a valid identity. That's a valid decision to have been made, and be open to those stories and your experiences, because I don't want there to be a vacuum where the only people that are willing to amplify your stories are these right wing outlets who may have nefarious intent for why they want to highlight certain stories over others. Because again, your experience is valid. At the end of the day, I think, you know, I won't really touch on the transitioning as a minor, because that's like a different debate that I unfortunately missed 2 weeks ago because I got the flu. But what I'm gonna say for this specific topic, which is whether the left ignores detransitioners. I guess where I want to end this is that I don't want to, and I want to rectify it and have those conversations, and engaging in a forum like this, I think is really helpful. Malcolm also had alluded to that there's risks with any medication. You want to talk about losing orgasms, SSRIs are a real bitch when it comes to impacting your sex drive. I have been on Lexapro for a while. I had been on Strattera led or, you know, Paxil back in the day. So it's about finding the right balance for you. And luckily, even though there are certain side effects of the medications I take that affect things like sex drive, I was informed by my doctor about those potential side effects ahead of time. I was able to make that fully informed decision on whether or not I wanted to pursue a specific treatment. And I think that is it shouldn't be a luxury. It just should be available to everyone. Everyone should get all the information they can so they can make the decision for them. And that's where I hope I'll leave things. But again, if you thought this was like a super spicy debate, don't watch any of the other debates I've been on, because you will be horrified. So thank you for making this so great.
Mm-hmm, that's right. I want to thank all four of our interlocutors, Maddie, Malcolm, Shapeshifter, and Kat, and remind everyone that their links are in the description below. With that, we are going to move over to our Q&A section. Please keep on sending them in, as well as your amazing super chats, like for $5 from Arcade Outpost. These studies are canonized by biased ideological activists in social sciences. Mm. Trust the study is as reliable as trust the church in the 1700s.
Based. The earth is actually flat and Bigfoot's real. Fucking based. What a king.
And our universe actually revolves around the moon.
I think the sun's flat too, actually. I'm a flat sunner.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
not
a flat
earther. Makes sense. I'm a flat sunner.
And with that, we're actually going to move on to our questions. I'm going to keep on looking for those to tag me. But also, we have a question from Chris G. Could you ask Kat to try and specify who she takes issue with instead of people who generally vote Dem?
So I actually have voted Dem in the past. And actually, that's a good point. Not all people on the left, support gender identity ideology. It is specifically people. I mean, I'd say it's specifically people on the left who are supporting the most radical of trans ideology, which is, trying to eliminate single sex spaces, putting male rapists in women's prisons, allowing, children at age 12 or younger to start puberty blockers and double mastectomies at age 13, like that, people promoting that on the left. And it is not everyone on the left. In fact, I'm actually struck by the fact that most people on the left don't even know these things are happening. They're really shocked when I tell them A, how quickly I was affirmed, and B, what's happening with kids. They're actually shocked. So, I'm not even conservative. I'm left leaning center. So it is a specific group on the left. It's not everyone.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that answer. And you got fans out there. Hillary's email says, Kat, that you are actually a chat favorite and that we're saying that you're awesome.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Because she has a cat. Look at that. How do you say no to that?
A cat with a cat.
Cat. Catception.
And I will say, we only have one more question out there. So if you have a burning desire to get your question for either all of our interlocutors, now is the time to do so. But Mike asks, question for for Malcolm. I can't recall, did you end up agreeing with Kat's interpretation of the studies you provided for the chat? Why?
No.
Or why not?
No. There were a few that we went over. The Swedish one specifically, the author herself has kind of come out and stated her, like that people that are reading the study are misinterpreting it, and that medical transition does decrease suicidality and improve quality of life. I don't even remember the other ones that we went over. The D-trans ones, somebody said earlier too that some of the studies can be biased, and like I agree depending on where you're sampling them from, which is why I like the physician survey the best, because you know, it's sent out to the physicians that provide this care. It's not just like snowball sampling with a SurveyMonkey link on Reddit posts. So yeah, I do disagree. I don't remember exactly every single one that we talked about, but those are the two ones that I remember.
And all right, on that note, I do want to thank you all for joining us here on Modern Day Debate. We are a neutral platform welcoming everybody from all walks of life. If you're looking for even more fantastic debates, we are now all over the internet, including your favorite podcasting platform. So if you enjoy debates like the one tonight, then please don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. It helps us reach an even wider audience, including tonight's debate on Does the Left Ignore D-Trans Folks? With our debaters, Maddie and Malcolm, and Shapeshifter and Kat, here to help us find that answer. Plus, if you like what any of our guests have said tonight, all of our links are in the description below. Finally, if you're looking for even more fun after the show, feel free to check out our MDD Discord. And with that, I am Amy Newman with Modern Day Debate.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.